Morning. It's good to see all of you. I started here with the testimony. Some of you know me from here. Some of you don't know me at all because I go to the early service. And some of you have lived with me and know me all my life. The reason we're starting, Pastor Bob has brought up these things lately about testimony, because testimony is how people know and see what Jesus does in our lives. Okay? So I'm going to start with mine. I was the kid, and the school teachers here will understand this. I was the kid when you had book reports, I wasn't getting up to do it. So if 5 years ago you'd have told me I'd be standing here, I'd have probably ran out the back door. But Jesus changes all our lives. Okay? And that's not it. See, now that's just a point. My main part of my testimony is I came to church here a long time ago, 20 some years ago. But I drifted off. You see, I had Jesus in my head. It wasn't that I didn't believe. I just didn't know that I didn't believe. And I know you don't understand that probably. You're probably sitting there going, what do you mean? See, I believed in my head about Jesus, but I didn't have my heart in it. Okay? So after wandering around, I had an accident and broke my ankle. And Pastor Bob was there. He always was. But see, I drifted away because sin was in my life. And I was still living in that life. I believed Jesus in my head, remember. But it wasn't here in my heart. So through the time of my broken ankle, and that was quite a time, the Spirit was still calling me. And one day we're going to the Jeep Fest, and the Spirit was calling me back. It was calling me back. Well, it was just calling me. And I said, okay, if I see Pastor Bob tonight at this Jeep Fest, I'll come back. Well, I parked, and before I walked to the back of my Jeep, guess who was there? So if you think the Spirit doesn't work, even whenever you're not speaking about God, it does. He didn't preach a sermon. He said, hi, how you doing? And he said, you know where to find us. And that was it. So back I came. So I'm back in church. Now keep in mind, I don't believe I was saved yet. I believe I had the head knowledge. And I was sitting in a pew, warming the pew. I wasn't doing the things that Pastor Bob was preaching about. I heard it, but I wasn't doing it. And then came a day, and Bob Seaver, who was here at the early service, they were passing out to read the Bible in a year. And I said to myself, all right, you want it? I'm going to give it to you. And I'm going to go for it. In 2 months, Jesus had me broken. Because I had seen everything that I missed. I had seen what sin does. He showed it to me in his word. And my life at that point changed. The Beatitudes came to life. I didn't need the explanation. It was in me now. So this is the power of our testimonies. And some of you, you may not understand. You may have a blank page right now. But one day, you'll see, you'll look back and you'll see. And he'll show you. And then, of course, we continue to write the story. I hope in 10 years that I can come and tell you all the great things that God has done. But we go on. We push on to Christ. All right. So we're going to get through that. 2 Peter 3. 2 Peter starts, he starts out, he writes, he says, this is now the second epistle that I'm writing to you, beloved, in which I stir up your sincere mind by way of reminder that you remember the predictions of the holy prophets and the commandment of Jesus by your apostles. I love that verse because he comes right out and he states exactly what he's going to do. He wants to stir up your sincere mind. So that tells me there's two parts to our mind. There's a part that wants to drag off and there's a part that's sincere. He wants to stir up the sincere part. And how he does this? By the predictions of the holy prophets. Remember the prophecies. So we're going to go into the prophecies today, and we're going to talk about the wise men, because the wise men fulfilled prophecies. They watched them, they learned them, they knew them, and then they did them. Proverbs 1, 2 through 7 says, to know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise ear hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance. To understand a proverb and the saying, the words of the wise and the riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. In this description, there's qualifications. And it's not race, it's not creed, it's not being Chinese, it's not being Jewish. This is for anybody. The fear of the Lord is where it begins. This is where the wisdom begins. You can become a wise man. The wise are all those who seek after the Lord and chases after his righteousness. He has all wisdom. You ask, he will give it to you. Just ask Solomon, he'll tell you. Now we go to the wise men, are also known as the Magi. One of the commentaries defines them as a class of priests among the Persians and the Medes who formed the king's council. They would be studying medicine, the occult, natural science. They were Eastern philosophers, interpreters, and interpreters of dreams. The Bible in Matthew 2 says wise men from the east came to Jerusalem. East of Israel was the Perinthian Empire at this time. The Roman Empire had Israel. Israel was smack right on the edge, and the Perinthian Empire was over here. These were foreigners, and they would have been traveling with an entourage. They were rich, they were wealthy. You don't bring gold by yourself in those days. You had soldiers, you had people with you. So they reported to Jerusalem. They did not go to Bethlehem. And they knew by the gifts they brought who they were going to see. Gold for the king, incense for God, and myrrh for his death and his burial. So I'm going to show you this little video, and we'll continue on.
From here, the people head into the plains of Moab. And the first main part of the section focuses on the strange figure of Balaam. So the king of Moab is freaked out at this huge group of people traveling through his territory. So he hires a pagan sorcerer, Balaam, to pronounce curses on Israel. And three different times, Balaam finds that he cannot curse them. He can utter only blessing upon Israel. Remember God's promise to Abraham from Genesis 12. So not only can Balaam not curse Israel, but God actually gives him a vision about a future Israelite king who will one day bring God's justice to all of the nations. This vision recalls Jacob's promise to Judah in Genesis chapter 49. Now, it's worth stopping to reflect on the flow of the book so far. The rebellion stories in the wilderness, they just heap up on one another, getting worse and worse. And while God does bring partial acts of judgment on Israel, he's also kept showing mercy, providing food and water along the way. And so the Balaam story, it shows God's grace in bright colors. Because here's Israel. They're down in the camp grumbling and rebelling. But up in the hills, unbeknownst to them, God is protecting and even blessing them. And it's this contrast between Israel's rebellion and God's faithfulness in the wilderness. That's what made these stories so important for later generations of Israel. So the wilderness stories are retold time and again by later biblical prophets and poets, and even by the apostles in the New Testament. And these stories always serve as a warning that while God will remain faithful to his covenant promises, he will also allow his people to walk away in rebellion and face the consequences. After this, the rest of the book focuses on the children of the wilderness generation, and they begin preparing to inherit the promised land. They take another census of the new generation, then they go on and win a number of battles with the people groups around them, and then a few tribes even begin to settle in the promised land. So the book ends with the new generation poised to enter into the land, and Moses is about to deliver his final words of wisdom and warning. But for now, that's what the book of Numbers is all about.
Nice little video there. We move on to, you see in Numbers 24:17, which is the picture that he drew of the king. It says, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and the scepter shall rise out of Israel. We have the star. We have the prophecy of the star. It's a small s in the Bible. If they were talking about Jesus and calling him the star, it would have been a capital S, but it's not. It's talking about an actual star. So Balaam was hired to curse the children of Israel, but instead he blesses him. He blesses him. In his vision, he sees Jesus. Now we go into the definition of behold. Sometimes words, when you get their actual definition, you think you know what they mean, but sometimes you don't. And it says to perceive through sight. to gaze upon. You see, Balaam up on that hill, he could see the king, and he's far away, but he's looking. He goes, that's him. And he's blessing the children and tell them he's coming from you guys. Now we're going to move forward because this is about prophecy, and we're going to move about 1,000 years before. Balaam happened about 1,400 years before Christ's birth. Now we move in and Babylon has fallen. The Jews are out of the land. They're now, or not Babylon, but Jerusalem has fallen. And they're carried off into Babylon to serve King Nebuchadnezzar. And now we have a young man named Daniel and his three friends, and they were given blessing of interpretation. They were and skilled in literature because they're going to serve in the king's court. This is what the Magi did. They served in the king's court. These were the best of the best, the smartest, the brightest. They studied in scripture. But see, we see here that Daniel and his friends are given it by God. Okay? And he also has the dream. He also has the understanding of visions and dreams. You see, God was working with his people, through his people, into the pagan world to show them. Now, this is where it gets interesting because the Magi were part of this group. So down through the years, they would have studied the scriptures. They had the book of Numbers. They had Daniel. And they had all the things that were going on at that time. So in Jeremiah 29:10, it tells us that they will be in Babylon for 70 years. And then right after that, it says, and I will visit. Now this is God speaking, not Jeremiah. God is going to visit them. So Daniel, perceiving towards the end, understanding the scriptures, he went and was making intercession for his people. Now he knows the time is near. And God gives him the timeline for the visitation. This timeline is in Daniel 9, 25 and 26. Do I have that up there? Yep. 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, to anoint a most holy place. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks it shall be built again with squares and a moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and have nothing. This is the prophecy. This is the timeline of the visitation. What we have in 70 weeks is 490 years. The weeks are sevens, is what they're talking about. So they're multiplying the seven by seven. That's where you get the first 49 years. This is where the temple and its walls are being rebuilt. And now you have 62 years as they continue on, which is 7 times 62, which is 434 years, which is bringing us to a point in time. You see, it's in a troubled time. Israel's not set free. Israel is under different empires the whole time. They are not free. And now we have the arrival of Jesus. The star rose. The Magi saw the star, went to Jerusalem, and we get into Matthew 2 here as we continue this. Because they knew the timeline. They knew what it would talk about. Now it says in there that the prince shall be cut off. When you read in the Old King James Version, it will say Messiah. It says Messiah. Okay? And that's in the Old King James. The newer versions say Prince. So these guys knew this because of everything that was handed down. The stories of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar losing his mind. Daniel in the lion's den. The fiery furnace. Everything that we have, they lived through and handed it down. Just like it's handed to us today. It's handed to us. We pick it up and take it. And that's the point. The witness is in the Bible. We have witnesses, just like they had teachers, to hand it down. Now we're back to Matthew 2. The wise men, they have entered Jerusalem. And this is where things change. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose. Now we see, they saw the star when it rose. It's not in the sky anymore. Okay? They saw the star and went to Israel. And they have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. All Jerusalem was troubled. Who is in Jerusalem? The Jews. Who is supposed to know the Messiah? Who were his people he chose? So the wise men went to Jerusalem thinking the king, God, is at the temple, is in Jerusalem. They should have all been there. But even they did not know. They did not know he wasn't there. But then King Herod, he calls all of them together, all his scribes and Pharisees, and he said, where is the Messiah to be born? And then they tell him, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people. So all of Jerusalem is troubled at this point. Jesus is already born. The wise men, they were far off. They didn't show up the night Jesus was born. He was already born, and they didn't know it. They missed the birth of the Messiah. So they came to worship him, and when they saw, and then they left out from Herod, and then another star appeared and led them right to where he was and stayed right over where Jesus was. John MacArthur calls this star the Shekinah glory of God. Could God make a star and just have people follow that are looking for it? Yes, he can. Does he show the way if you seek him? Yes, he does. This is the point to salvation. That baby born in the manger, this is all pointing to him. So in Esther 8, I'm going to go back to Esther 8 because there's a small little verse in there that's hidden in Esther 8. And most everybody here should know the story of Esther, how she became queen, and the king was kind of I wouldn't call him a powerful king, but he was king. And a bad guy named Haman is leading him down to kill all the Jews. He wants all the Jews killed, so he leads the king and traps him in his own words. And Mount Mordecai tells Esther, you have to tell him who you are, because he wants to kill us all. And it's his time. So the king cannot go back on his edict, but he can change a new edict, and this is what he did. And in every province and every city where the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, and a feast and a holiday. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. You see what happened here? The Jews were allowed to defend themselves, and God using them, others came into them, came into being Jews. So what happens? What did Jews do at this time? They go to synagogue, right? And they have what we know as the seven feasts of God. These seven feasts are very interesting because they point to Jesus. They point to that baby in the manger. What I want you to do is when you see those, look up like and look down and say, that's him. This is the one. The first Passover was in Egypt. In the first month of our spring, on the 10th day, you would take a lamb. One lamb for each house. There's one. That keeps coming up in the Bible. One way to God. One lamb. It's one. So you take that lamb from the 10th day, and it would come into your house till the 14th day and be killed at twilight. Two reasons for this. First reason, each day represents 100 years that the Jewish people were in bondage. So that comes up to 400 years of bondage. God came and took them out. All right? The other reason, that little lamb you get to play with and watch and run around, and then you have to kill it. It's grievous. Just like our sin is grievous to God, and his son died for us. It grieves God, our sin. This is the purpose for the lamb to be there. Now we're introduced to the cross at this with the blood that was put on the doorways, the lintels and the top. It was not put on the threshold. For Hebrews 10:29 tells us, how much worse a punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God, and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and outraged the Spirit of grace. You see, the blood doesn't go on the floor, on the threshold, because you'd walk over it. You don't walk over the blood of Jesus. It is a high price. Then we have the reflection of the Lamb. It says, they shall eat the flesh that same night. It's all gone. The second part of that, roasted with fire. You did not boil it. In fact, they even used pomegranate wood to roast it because it's a dry wood. It does not have any liquid it to boil. But the roasted with fire, remember what Jesus did on the cross? My Lord, my God, why have you forsaken me? He took on our punishment. He took on the punishment of hell. He felt the fire for us so that we don't have to. And they shall eat it with unleavened bread. And we're going to get to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is the next one, which is very, very interesting. I'm going to explain that one. Unleavened bread, get the leaven out. Sin is, leaven represents sin. We know this. And we're going to get to it. And then it says you must eat it with bitter herbs. That's another one. Back to the lamb that you have to kill. The bitter herbs, you're going to go, like lemon. You're eating a meal. And then you're eating the bitterness. Well, once again, it's a picture of our sin to God. We get that picture. See, he's forming a picture in all these for the future. And then there's four cups of wine during this meal. The first cup, a blessing or sanctification, where he says, I will bring you out. Remember, Egypt is a representation of sin. See, this is how it's important today. He will bring you out. He brought them out of Egypt. And here's the picture. He's bringing us out of sin. Out of Egypt we go. The second cup is the praise of giving praise to God for his promise. I will deliver you out of bondage. The cup of praise. We sing hymns today. And we glorify him as we speak. Now, this is the third cup. This is very important that I'm going to talk about right now because this is the one we're actually going to do here in a little bit. The third cup is important because it's the cup of redemption. He bought us with his blood. You're taking that on. You're accepting that fact whenever we come to that table. This is where Paul's referring when he says we were bought with a price. Matthew 26:28 says, for this is my blood of the covenant which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. And now this is the interesting part because this is where Jesus stops the Passover. He stopped. Now remember, we go back to the prophecy of 490 years. We have 483 years and Messiah is cut off. That leaves 7 years. We're in a period of a pause. Jesus paused the Passover and went to be sacrificed. He sang a hymn and went out. And now there is one more cup in that thing remaining. This cup is called the cup of the kingdom. You see, it's not here yet, but it's coming. See, we have 7 more years of the tribulation, then Jesus is going to return. And when he returns, the fourth cup is when we will be in the kingdom. Matthew 26:29, but I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Imagine being there that day. You can be there that day. Imagine with Jesus. So the Passover, now we move into the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Jews have a game that they play during this feast called Bedikat Shemetz, and I don't know if that's the right pronunciation. I try my best. You need candles, a wooden spoon, a feather, and 10 leavened crumbs of bread, and a furnace of fire. I like this game because it's got a picture. It's got a picture to it and a promise. And here it goes. The father gives the candles to the children. The children are sent out with the light to find the bread, the leavened bread. You see the picture starting to form? The light points to our sin. All right? And then what do? They cry out, Father, Father, we have found leaven. Now they use 10 crumbs. We have 10 commandments, right? You see the picture? It's starting to form. Now he has a wooden spoon. What do we do with the wooden spoon? He goes and he takes the feather and he gently pulls the crumbs up, throws them into the furnace of fire. It's a cool little game. Easy to teach with, right? You get the picture? The light goes out, searches our hearts for the sin. We cry out to him, and he takes it away. Then we have the first fruits. It's another feast. The barley is the first harvest. And this is an interesting, very, very interesting of the harvest. The barley harvest, it is bent over. The head of the stalks are bent over. This is the representation to the church. You can bow. You can bow now. And that's the point. He has come for his church. John, in John, in the book of John, he says, that John the Baptist says, I am not he, but the one who comes. He has his winnowing fork in his hand. Do you get that? He's going to take his church. It's the beginning of the church. We're going to be separated. And the barley is tossed and winnowed, and the kernels fall away from the chaff. He's going to separate the good from the chaff. Because the head is soft and bowed down. And the next harvest is the wheat, which is opposite. It is stiff. It is hard. So they harvest the wheat and they crush it. That's how you get the grains out. You have to crush it. This is the tribulation period. These are the ones pictured in the tribulation period because they have to go through a hard time. Now, I always told you that I live my life to my way. And Jesus, and if he controls everything, then that day he allowed my ankle to be smashed. He allowed it to be smashed for my own good. At the time, I could not see that. Couldn't see it. But I look back on it now, and the worst day of my life became the best because I stopped living to myself in time, and I saw it. This sometimes is what we have to go through here, and praise God that he'll do it. He'll do it to save you. But some people are going to have to go through the hard part of that life. Next harvest in the fall is the fruit harvest. This is not good. Because the angel of the Lord, he says, set your sickle in. It's time for the grapes. And they're put into the great winepress of the wrath of God. This is the picture in the end times now. These are the ones who are not saved. And God's going to pour out his wrath. One of the other neat little things in there is whenever they harvested their fields, they left the corners. The corners were left for the poor. They could come through and they could take whatever they needed. These are called the gleanings. And these picture in the end times are the people who are saved who make it through the tribulation. There's going to be a few. And they're going to repopulate the earth. Now, if you've gone on to glory, you'll be in your glorified body with Jesus. Be different for you. But if you survive this and walk into the kingdom, you'll be like you are today, but made whole. And of course, we know Pentecost. Pentecost, when it first started, was called the Feast of Weeks. This was when the law was given, when the Ten Commandments came down off the mountain, and 3,000 people died. But it's been changed to Pentecost, because what happened at Pentecost, we know, the Spirit was given. Peter, preached a sermon, and we watched Peter in his life get all messed up all the way through, and he did some good, and he did some bad, and he was kind of this way and that way. But that day, he changed. The Spirit was given to him, and he changed. And we have the sound of the rushing of the wind. It wasn't a wind that blew in, but it was the sound. Can anybody say the winnowing fork and the chaff being blown away? You understand the pictures. It's a beautiful picture. So, Jesus' life is laid out for us to know. The times, the timeline. The wise men studied the scriptures to know and to learn. And they were the ones that saw the star. The outsiders saw the star, while those who were supposed to know didn't see it. But it rose out of Israel. It said, the star will rise out of Jacob. So there it was. So when the wise men came and announced the birth in Jerusalem, they called them all together and said, what is this? And how did I miss it? The important part to this to know is that we're not to miss. You missed the birth of Jesus, and they were still okay. But there's going to come a second coming, and you can't afford to miss it. We must know the signs of the times. Just like in the Passover is paused. And that 490-year period is paused. Today is the day of grace. Today is the day of salvation. Bow now. Believe in your heart. If you didn't understand from my testimony, from believing to your head to your heart, understand it's about, if you were in the Magi shoes and you saw the star, are you going to walk 800 miles to see the king, his birth? Are you going to bring him gifts? Do you understand the point? The point is knowing, and the other point is knowing and doing. So my favorite verse in the Bible is Luke 21:34-36. I love this. I memorize it. And I say it to myself often. It says, do not let your hearts become weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. So what he's saying? Do not let dissipation and drunkenness and the cares of this life. The cares of this life is everyday living, right? We're to be looking forward, because that day is capitalized. That day is going to be a bad day. It's going to be a bad day, because that's the day it closes, when those feet land and the world will see. But then it goes on to tell you, it tells me, but to be watchful and praying so that you will be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. You see, there's the escape. The escape is in the blood of that baby. When he died for us, he paid the price. On the Day of Atonement, we've said, there's been two goats. There's a scapegoat and there's a sacrificial goat. The sins were laid on the scapegoat and led to the wilderness. Jesus fulfills both of them. He takes your sin. He takes your sin. It isn't just for God. He takes it and bears the brunt of the punishment. But he's also the sacrifice. You see how he fulfilled both. So today, let it go. Let your heart go. And don't let the cares of this life take you down. All right, we're about to go into our time of communion. We're going to do it a little bit different this morning. We're going to be quiet as we go about this. Nikki is going to sing a song when the guys get halfway or three quarters of the way through. I want you guys to focus on Jesus. Focus on what he's done. Focus on what I told you of how it's the third cup of redemption and the fourth one is to come. Confess your sin to him. And then Nikki's going to start singing. And as you finish, we're going to rise up and sing. We're going to sing praise to him like the second cup.